Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is attending the funeral of a dear friend today. Most kids at some point find themselves the victim of cruel behavior by another child. What can be more difficult to understand is how even the best-behaved children can be the perpetrators of intentional meanness. The reasons apparently are rooted in the very nature of adolescence. Joining me in the studio to talk about social cruelty among children and what to do about it, Melody Mead, principal of Washington International School's primary school, Patrick Welsh, an English teacher at T.C. Williams High School in Virginia, and Carl Pickhart, a psychologist and the author of a new book entitled Why Good Kids Act Cruel. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
It's good to be here.
Thanks, Susan.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number. That's 1-800-433-8850. Or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. So, Carl, answer the question posed in the title of your book. Why do good kids act cruel?
Well, I root it in early adolescent change when somewhere around the age of 9 to 13, kids separate from childhood. And at the point that they do that, they enter an age of extreme developmental security. What they've done is they've cast off the security of childhood. They don't want to be treated as a child anymore. They start pushing and pulling away from parents, so they get much more resistance with parents, and that relation gets more abrasive, and all of a sudden they want social independence with friends. And all their friends are developmentally insecure the way they are, and they are desperate to find social place with each other. And in service of finding some kind of social independence with peers, they can treat each other very meanly. And those are good kids, mostly. I mean, a lot of the times that do that. It's not bad kids.
So, Melody, you work with elementary school kids and middle school kids. What kind of behaviors do you see that we might think of as being pretty mean?
Well, I think that Carl's right, that as the children start to shed off their childlike selves and try and distance themselves from adults, what we see is that the children do start to rally so that they can find their places in schools. And I think that what happens is, as they're searching for more independence, schools also allow them for this independence, and yet we don't always provide safe structures for them in terms of how they can explore themselves and also connect with their learning and their social learning.
So, Carl, we're talking about things like bullying other kids.
Well, yeah, well, the five kinds of social cruelty that I see have to do with teasing, which is a major one, exclusion, bullying, rumoring, and ganging up. And all of those, in service of all of those, what happens is that kids will treat each other in mean ways to exercise dominance or to protect themselves or to create social place.
Now, Patrick, you work with kids at the high school level. Do you see those kind of behaviors in high school as well?
Yeah, and one of the ironies that I see, I teach at T.C. Williams in Alexandria, which is what they call a majority-minority school, where Latino and black students outnumber white students, and many white parents in the community, they've been afraid to send their daughters to our school because they think they're going to be harassed by African-American guys or by Latino guys. And you talk to the white girls about it, and they'll say, it's not the guys we fear. The people we fear most that are going to ruin our day are other white girls. It's their peers. And they say that it's not physical stuff, but it's the looks, the vibes, the rumor, the sexual rumors especially, mocking physical flaws and the whole attempt to destroy reputation.
Right.
And most of those kind of conflicts I see are they never go outside their groups. Like if there's going to be confrontations, whatever, it'll be white girls and white girls, black girls, Latino guys, whatever. So a lot of those fears that parents have are baseless. And what parents miss is what Carl is saying, that the pain is going to come from their own peer group.
Now, Melody talked about this is in part the result of young adolescents trying to break free, to figure out how to be independent. What's going on, do you think, with high school kids when they behave in these cruel ways to one another?
Well, there's kind of an irony about this generation, I think, that they are infinitely more tolerant of difference than previous generations. I've had guys in my class who are transvestites other students don't bat an eyelash. Girls that have come out of the closet declaring that they're lesbians, guys declaring that they're gay. And there's almost a total acceptance, especially of kids who will come out and be courageous enough to say, well, I'm this or I'm that. So on the one side, this is an extremely tolerant generation. But on the other, there's still, and I would say, maybe it sounds sexist, but especially with girls, the psychological violence. And another kind of, it's humorous, but it's not humorous, where you see guys, when guys get in physical confrontations, they're usually looking over their shoulders for someone to break it up. A few years ago, two guys get off the bus and start a fight in front of the principal and in front of a cop. And the principal pulls him into his office and says, why did you fight in front? He said, we knew you'd break it up.
Yeah, years ago, I was talking to the director of security down at in New Orleans and in the school district. And he was talking about how you break up a fight. And he said, you look at who's fighting and you see which one wants to quit. And you confront that kid. And that kid will go with you because, you know, they're looking for a way out and you're giving them a safe way out.
Yeah, I find boys look for the way out. But they're girls. We've had some fights with girls where you cannot pull them off each other. They're a little more serious.
Well, Melody, do you agree with Patrick that girls tend to be, not in every case, but tend to be maybe a little crueler than boys?
Yes, definitely. And I think that what girls do is that they work and it can go underneath the radar screen of the adults. And one thing that Carl had talked about in his book is that there's the life of the teacher being in control in the classroom, and then the students say they're the ones that are in control of the hallways. And I think that with a lot of observation and wisdom, you know how the kids are always texting each other. Well, there's also the social texting in the classrooms without the electronics. Mm-hmm. And it's the looks, and you can see it in the classroom. You can see it in the hallways. And I do think that girls go underneath the radar screen, but they don't need to, because if we're very clever and observant and enter into the dialogue, we can bring those behaviors back into the classroom so that we can address them. Not necessarily bringing the behavior into the classroom, but bringing the topic into the classroom.
So what kind of things would be under the radar screen that maybe a teacher or a parent wouldn't notice?
I think you have three girls walking down the hall one day, and then you have two girls walking down the hall the next day.
Right.
And you can see that somebody is just the way they hold themselves. You can see that girls might be very concerned about their looks, and an adult looking at them would see a group of lovely children and never anticipate that they're sitting there in angst. And they're not really worried about the lesson that's in front of them. They're worried about the part of their hair. And so these kinds of things, if we open it up and we talk to them about it, then we have entered into the dialogue where we become a part of their world and they become a part of our world on the journey.
So our phone lines are open. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. Well, you know, life is hard. Life is hard when you're a kid. Life doesn't get entirely easy once you're all grown up. Should we worry about this, or is a little bit of teasing or bullying just one of those things kids need to get used to?
Well, there's going to be a certain amount of push and shove and rough and tumble. But what you look for are the three major risks, and the risks are 1, to self-esteem, 2, to social safety, and 3, to whether this is socially formative. For example, if you have somebody who has been bullied, they can become somebody who becomes intimidated later because they don't know how to take up for themselves. Or the bully can become coercive because they learn to do that. So it has formative effect. The other part of it is if, in fact, school becomes not safe, then academic focus is lost. You cannot have a successful academic school unless it is socially safe. And early adolescence and social cruelty jeopardizes that because it focuses the kids, you know, on what is social survival, and that's more important.
Do you see impact, Patrick, that we should worry about from some of these social cruel things that can happen?
As I said before, I think this generation is infinitely more tolerant than other generations that have come before. But the thing that worries me, and I'd be interested in comments on this, is that kids have all these new temptations with texting, with Facebook, and all these other, in internet activities where they can, you know, fall off the cliff as far as being mean to each other. And it's as a teacher, you worry about kids being distracted by by texting, by Facebook, and whatever. But there's also the fact that they can get much meaner, but as they hide behind.
Well, it's huge now. The internet has totally expanded and created enormous jeopardy now for kids, because with a click, you know, a simple click, and a rumor is sent, and you can flame somebody, and you can bring their reputation down, and they come to school the next day, and all of a sudden, people don't want anything to do with them, and they don't know what's been said about them.
What would be an example of somebody flaming somebody?
Well, it can be somebody, a kid, okay, a girl comes to school, she's new to school, she's attractive, she was very popular in the last school, very sociable, with a good athletic competitor, comes to school, and all of a sudden what happens is she notices that nobody wants anything to do with her. And she doesn't understand that, because she's always been successful. And what she finds out is that somebody has started rumors about her that, you know, she's got some kind of a sexual disease, and that she was sexually active in the past school where she came from, and you better stay away from her, because you don't want to, you know, you don't want to catch that. And that rumor has been circulated by girls who want to protect their social position with their boys, and they don't want to have to, you know, deal with the competition.
But even before the internet, girls have told me this: if a new girl comes into school, mm-hmm. and she's, you know, reasonably attractive, and if she gets popular with the boys,
right.
you know, and as you say, if she's a good athlete, whatever,
right.
they'll destroy her. They will just rip her apart.
Right.
Wherever the Queen Bee group is, it's already established.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Patrick Welsh, Carl Picard, and Melody Mean about social cruelty and what parents, teachers, and kids themselves can do about it. We're going to go to the phones as well, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio is Carl Picard. He has a new book out called Why Good Kids Act Cruel, The Hidden Truth About the Preteen Years. And also joining us in the studio, Melody Mead. She's the principal of the Washington International School's primary school. And Patrick Welsh. He's an English teacher at T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia, and he frequently writes about education matters. So what can we do if you see kids who are being persecuted, or you see a kid who seems to be falling into becoming kind of mean and cruel toward peers? What, for starters, what can parents do, Carl?
Well, I mean, I think key off what Melody said. If in service of social independence, kids are given a safe structure and they're given instruction about how to treat each other in considerate and not cruel ways, that can make an enormous difference. The problem with social cruelty is that it's under the adult radar, and partly that's a function of the fact that kids want an independent social life. So they push parents away, and they push teachers away, and they think that parents and teachers don't know, don't care, and can't do anything about it, and that is not true. But what parents have to do is, particularly, they have to take the initiative. They have to say, at this age, you need to know that kids can be mean to each other in the following ways, and should that ever come your way, you know, please let's talk about it so we can make sure that damage is not done. And the greatest damage is when kids take it personally.
So parents should be proactive about this before they see a problem.
Absolutely be proactive about it. Otherwise, kids will say, my parents don't know. And parents need to know.
Melody, what about teachers and principals like yourself? Well, what can they do?
I think so much of what we're talking about is tried and true and very old. They're, you know, adolescence has remained unchanged from when we all grew up. And I think there's, in a sense, a social amnesia of some of the cruelties that we received and that we enacted on other kids ourselves growing up. What has changed is the context of what happens now. And as schools might get bigger or as the internet does have a different interface where a child used to write something that was a thought in a diary now can become a very public exposure. And there's danger in that. And I think that what we need to do in terms of responding is recognize the context of the world in which the children live, open up the conversation, as Carl was saying, but also really be aware of how they're interacting with the world and share with them some of the dangers. If they are knowledgeable about the internet and knowledgeable about how they use these things, we cannot stop them. We have to allow them to experiment. So I think really having the dialogue in safe areas, there are things that we can talk about without the direct conversation all over the place. Television, movies, books, politics. The children think those are what we're talking about, whereas actually we may have an agenda to get to other topics within those larger topics.
So how about the kids themselves, Patrick? If there's a student who sees friends acting mean to each other, what can kids themselves do about that?
Our school has a peer mediation program that's really worked very well. In fact, President Clinton came to our school several years ago and saw that as an example that could work in other schools. So if a couple of kids are having, whether it's a physical confrontation or just being mean to each other or a couple of groups being mean to each other, an administrator will grab either the leader of each group or if it's a pair of kids, they'll grab the kids and they'll have a mediation with a peer, with other students who've been trained to do the mediation. And it's amazing how often that whatever the conflict is, when they sit down and talk about it, they realize, and a lot of them said they'll laugh about it, they realize how silly it was. And the two enemies will often become friends. But the one thing Melody was mentioning about politics. It seems that the level of political discourse today is so, I mean, they're like middle school girls, many of these politicians, who will not discuss issues or just will tear each other apart and will never look at the so-called other. And we're asking young kids going through identity problems to look at the other and to be kind. And they've got adults out there who are supposed to be role models who are just gouging each other left and right. So we live in a society, especially with a 24-hour news cycle, where adults are ripping each other apart and where destroying reputations is entertainment.
That's such an interesting point. I wonder, Carl, do you think that this has fed kids feeling like this is an okay way to behave?
Absolutely. The internet is the greatest rumor mill ever created. And kids can see reputations being attacked and destroyed without any kind of substantial merit behind them. And kids can do it with each other, and they do it with each other. And I mean, but again, all of this is intentional behavior. If you will bring this up for discussion about how would folks like to treat each other, all kids that I've ever seen is they want to treat each other in a safe way. But sometimes they don't know how or they don't dare. They feel if they don't push, you know, all of a sudden they might get hurt. And so they get very protective and defensive. And the mediation thing, one of our sons was in middle school, was trained in mediation. And I remember he mediated a relationship between two guys on the basketball team that would not get along with each other, so they couldn't play together. and he was called in to mediate that. And I don't know the mechanisms of it, but in fact, that was marvelous training. And in fact, those two boys were able to learn how to work together.
Well, Melody, what if a kid is feeling picked on and everyone's mean to him or her? What should they do?
Well, I think, first of all, a lot of the children feel very lonely, and adolescents feel very lonely in what's happening to them. And so, in general, the kids need to receive the opportunity to talk about they are not the only ones that are experiencing this. And that, in and of itself, is a huge comfort. Mm-hmm. And a child that's being picked on, just being able to recognize that and either share it with somebody who's safe, a parent or a teacher, a good friend, allows them to acknowledge it and work through it. And I think there's a lot of interesting things about adolescence that teachers and parents worry about. For example, it's excellent for an adolescent to have one good friend. And people may become concerned because they feel that their child is becoming subsumed by this friend. And that's what adolescents do. They go into an extreme. So they have an extremely close mm-hmm. relationship with a girl or with a boy of the same sex, generally. Mm-hmm. And that's where they learn how to confide. They learn how to try on different roles. And these are typical things that an adult might worry about, but just like we accept two-year-olds perhaps will bite a child in a preschool situation, we need to accept that these are interactions that are healthy for adolescents. And so a child feeling bullied needs their friends and their adults.
Patrick, what do you advise if a kid came to you as a sophomore in high school came to you and said, everybody's mean to me, no one will talk to me, they say all these things about me that aren't true. What would you tell that person to do?
Well, I think what I would try to do is to find out who the people are. And like if they were in a class of mine and to talk to them and to confront them. But I don't really know what I would tell the child himself who's being bullied, that maybe to hang in there, and maybe that's just the way things are, and maybe you'll have to be patient. But I would try to get a hold of those who are doing the bullying, and in a nice way to confront them. And very often they will back off if you can find who they are.
And I think having somebody who is being bullied understand that it may not necessarily be about them. It's much more about somebody who is bullying them. Mm-hmm. And so there you take it off of the ego of the child who suddenly feels very self-conscious about the aspect, the one thing that bully has teased out about them that could be a very truthful thing. And yet the bully is saying so much more about themselves. And that sounds very obvious in the adult world, but that dialogue with the children helps them take it out of their own experience and be able to confront the situation and even better confront the bully with the support of adults.
You know, Carl, all of us as parents have had the experience where we find out something about our kids that they either tell us or we find out in some other way, and the kid says, don't do anything about it. I don't want you to go to school. Don't talk to my teacher. Don't talk to my friends. Should parents should they pay attention to what their kids are saying then, or do they have an obligation to step in?
Well, but the contract is, if you don't want me to go to school on your behalf to see if I can do something to stop this, then what I want to do with you is to be able to talk with you about this as this unfolds. Because my concern is that, number one, you don't take it personally. You understand it's not about you. It's about other people wanting to be mean. And number two is that you have the resources to be able to take care of yourself. You know, at the point that it looks to me like you don't have the resources, then I want us to be able to discuss that. Because I know what you're saying is you don't want me in their world because that might make it worse. But, you know, if we reach, a hard time when all of a sudden you're scared about going to school, you're not feeling safe, you're feeling badly about yourself, you can't focus on your studies, you know, then we've got to look at you getting some additional support, and we want to be part of that support.
And when it gets to that point, having faith in a dialogue with the teacher or the administrator to handle it without almost busting the child. It's to handle it without bringing attention to what they feel is that they are the informer.
Patrick, can parents make it worse when they try to help?
Yeah, but I think parents can, let's say, one of the good things about the internet is that parents can email teachers and they can alert them to what's going on. And most teachers I know are not going to tell the child. If the parent wants it to be kept confidential, it will be kept confidential. And I would say the parents should contact teachers. And because if I have a class, let's say, when I go back today, a class of 25 kids. Now, I can't know what's going on with everybody in that class, but if a parent alerts me, I'm going to be really aware of that child. In fact, my theory in general is that parents, if the biggest favor they can do their kids in a school is to get to know the teacher so that the teacher can connect the face of the parent with the child. And then the teacher, it's not favoritism, but the teacher just can't help but take care of that child or be aware of that child.
Well, let's go to the phones and take a call and some questions from our listeners. We're going to go first to Phoenix, Arizona, and talk to Dave. Dave, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I wonder all this really does for kids if we allow it to mature into the kind of behavior that you talked about in the media and within, you know, like Congress. And so I'd like to the panel to reflect a little bit about how you see these kinds of behaviors in your own workplace, whether it's in the school or at the radio station, and how you deal with those.
All right. Dave, thanks for your call. What do you think?
I'm not clear. You have to restate the question is.
Well, I think we see a lot of these behaviors anyway. I think I took an organizational behavior class, and I think we refer to it as Machiavellian behavior, where some of the high achievers are allowed to act this way.
Okay. Well, certainly all these behaviors are not limited to children treating children and adolescents treating children, treating each other. It's also, obviously, it's manifested with adults treating adults. But I think, you know, what our job is, well, so far as the kids are in our educational care, is to do what we can as parents, as teachers, to teach them to treat each other well, because that has formative effect. If kids learn that they can create a social world with each other and create social place with each other without doing each other harm, that is a powerful lesson for now and later, and it is a lesson worth giving.
It's certainly true that in all of us probably know some adults that engage in teasing or exclusion or bullying, although I think it's probably not quite as painful as it is when you're an adolescent. Do you think that's right, Patrick?
Yeah, I think that adults do that about, you know, who's going to get invited to this party or who doesn't get invited. In fact, there was a party a couple of weeks ago that my wife and I didn't get invited to. We were very hurt. But I think one thing I try to push with kids, and we have a school where there's a lot of immigrants, and my idea is if you want to get to know the world and really get to know what we're about, get to know the kids in your class. We've had Afghan students. When the war in Afghanistan started, a lot of people didn't know where Afghanistan was. My students did, because they had kids from Kandahar and Kabul sitting next to them in class. If you make an effort to get to know those people, you enrich your life enormously rather than exclude them.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Yeah, I do think that even though you were very hurt by not being invited to this dinner, you do tend to take it less personally, maybe, than when you're 13. Let's go back to the phones. We'll go to Matthew, who's calling us from South Bend, Indiana. Matthew, thanks for holding on.
Thank you. I have a question. I have a soon-to-be 21-year-old daughter who was bullied in middle school and high school. And I kept talking to her about confronting the people who were bothering her. And I guess my question boils down to is, it seems like there's a certain type of child that gets bullied, that gets picked on. And what is it, I guess, I don't understand as an adult, and I didn't understand as a child, I guess, what is it about that kid that the other kids see? What weakness do they see?
All right, Matthew, thanks for your call. Carl, what do you think?
Well, I think what happens is if they see somebody that they think is not likely to talk back to them, is not likely to stand up to them, particularly bullies. Bullies are not looking for a fight. Bullies are looking for somebody who won't give them a fight, you know, who they can push around and exercise dominance over. So if they see somebody that is seems to be uncommunicative, appears passive, and is easy to push around and won't speak up for themselves, a lot of times that person will be selected.
Carl, in your book, Why Good Kids Act Cruel, you tell a story about a time when you yourself acted like a bully. What happened?
Well, it was one of the great lessons of my life. I was 11 or 12 years old. My parents sent me to a week-long day camp, and I guess I was feeling insecure. I was an early adolescent kid, and there was this big kid, Tim, there. And I found out that if you could say scary things to Tim, he'd act really scared. And I thought, oh, boy, that was pretty good. And so I was saying scary things, and he was getting upset. And finally, one of the counselors, I remember that counselor's name was Mike. Mike came up to me at the end of the week and said, Carl, would you like to box Tim? And I thought, well, that'll be great, man. I'll get in there, and I'll slam him, and I'll be big, and he'll be small, and he's bigger than me. And so Mike set up a ring with the ropes, and he had a whistle and put on boxing gloves. And Tim came at me like a windmill. I mean, he was wheeling and he had me down in a minute. And what I realized afterwards, I'm sure Mike coached him in that. But what I came away with from that was a wonderful, you know, lesson and an appreciation of Tim. Number one is I appreciated the courage of Tim, because he was scared and he mastered his fear and he came after me. And I learned that it is no big guy. It doesn't make you big to try to push somebody around.
And it makes you maybe also appreciate Mike's intervention.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was a wonderful intervention because he encouraged and coached this kid to take up for themselves against this kid who thought he was big stuff. And that kid learned that he was not big stuff.
We're going to take another short break, and then we'll come back and continue our conversation about why kids can be act mean to each other, what the effects of that can be, and what parents and teachers can do about it. And we'll go back to the phones and take some of your calls and questions. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. This is NPR.
Many of the employees of private military contractors who were severely injured while helping fight the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been cheated out of their health insurance benefits or have had to fight for months or years to get them. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with investigative reporter T. Christian Miller of ProPublica. Join us.
We have an email from Dick. He writes that he's now 63, that he was raised in a good family with two caring parents, that he's got three college degrees and has been very successful in life. But he writes, underscoring all of that with a dark undertone is the scarring left from 3 years of being the object of bullying, seared into place by inadequate or absent redress. It has permanently damaged all my other activities by sabotaging my confidence to step up at critical points. Such a sad story. Dick writes, I have tried to take steps with my own children, lots of discussion and self-defense training, which I hope has prevented them from carrying something like this in their lives. Things like enrolling in karate to say you never start a fight with your peers, but if one is visited upon you, you finish them. What do you think about what Dick is writing about? Is this a good technique for parents to think about if a child's being bullied?
Well, I think this to stand up for you, know how to stand up to yourself, particularly for boys who, where the bullying tends to be more aggressive, being able to position yourself, being able to create a nonverbal presence that other kids will respect. There's a huge nonverbal arsenal that kids need to have. That's less an issue like when Melody describes with girls. You know, it's girls. The social cruelty is more bully. It was more rumoring and exclusion. Boys, it's more teasing and bullying.
But I think, the standing up for yourself will take different forms. And
right.
So, while this gentleman's put forward that he's going to have martial art classes, that's a very obvious form.
Right.
I think that if you give children specific lines, and then they make those lines themselves. They take a response and they say it in their own way, and that is providing them with the tools so that they can manage some of these situations. And it's not always going to work, but at least they have a starting point and they'll learn as they go.
What would be an example of what a child could kind of rehearse in their own head to say and then use when they need to? What's an example of a line?
Well, there are a lot of different lines. You know, one is when like somebody's teasing them. I mean, they could say, oh yeah, that's really funny. You know, they could laugh at that. They could say, so what? They could say, you know, when you say that, you know, it really hurts my feelings. They can say, you know, when you're through teasing me, let's go do something fun. I mean, a lot of different lines. I mean, that's what coaching does. There's a huge difference between being a target and a victim. You don't want your kid to be a target of social cruelty, but you sure don't want them to be a victim. Targets have power. Targets say, I know I'm receiving it, it's about them, it's not about me, and what I need is strategies, and parents give them strategies. When you're a victim, you have no choice. You don't want your kid in victim mode, and that's what Dick was describing. He was in victim mode. He had no way to get to the target position where he could find a way to take care of himself.
But literally,
I think that line, what you're saying, really hurts me. It's a great line that would stop a lot of people, but not too many boys I teach would ever say that. And what I'm not constantly, but often talking to guys about, if somebody's giving you a hard time, do not confront them. We have a school policy where, you know, you're suspended if you're in a fight. Do not let them egg you on into a fight. Mm. And a lot of times we have to talk. Guys will say,
right,
the only thing you've got to strike back. And you strike back physically if somebody's giving you a hard time. And I try to preach against that and try to have them either take the guy to some kind of peer mediation or to have some kind of line, some kind of verbal confrontation that gets away from punching somebody out.
Yeah.
It would be very comforting if there's a list of lines that we could all provide, and that's what works. But I think part of it is the work of sitting down with a young person and coming up with things that make sense for them.
Right.
And then when they try it, it may work, but it may not. And that's the reality. And they have to keep trying, and they
exactly.
have to keep going. And the important thing is, what is the goal? The goal is to get this person off of you. And to regain your own respect and your own ability to maneuver through the day.
Dick, I want to thank you for that very interesting email. And we're going to now, Kate, read an email from Margaret, who writes us from San Antonio. And she says, your focus seems to be on how bullied kids should cope. What's much more important is to identify and change the behavior of the bullies. What are the techniques that parents should be using to pick out the bullies and get those parents involved? So how do you identify? First of all, is it perfectly obvious who the bullies are?
A lot of times parents don't know until somebody tells them, and sometimes parents will take offense at the message and they'll say, not my child. So if somebody tells you that your kid is bullying, you need to take that seriously, because as a parent, you don't want your kid learning to push people around now, because they'll do it to push around people later in significant relationships. So the job is essentially to be able to, you know, you start by saying, you know, how would you like, you know, if you were on the receiving end of this treatment, how would it feel for you? You know, and then do you actually believe that this is a right way to treat people? And you try to give them some kind, explore, you know, those dimensions of it, what empathetically what it's going to be like and ethically what it's like, because you want to enter into those discourse. At least you want to raise those issues with them. And then you want to be able to say to them, you don't understand. I'm talking about this with you now, because if we don't talk about it now, it may cause you problems later if you continue these ways.
Well, and I think resistance of accepting that your own child or your own student might be a bully. In truth, if we look at ourselves and you think back on your own childhood and your own adolescence, most of us at one moment had a time when we were cruel to someone else. And I think that really helps parents and teachers understand that it's not this dark horse that doesn't exist and you're the only one.
Right.
Once again, it's something that's common, and so what will we do about it?
Right. So, Patrick, do you run into kids at high school who have gotten into kind of a pattern of being a bully, not effective intervention in middle school or earlier, and what do you do about it at that point?
I think you have to confront those kids, and my line often is, you're better than that. And we used to have an athletic director in our school, who's A.K. Johnson, who was a draft choice for the Houston Oilers, and let's just say a very large man. And all he would have to do is talk to a kid who was a bully, and the bullying would end forever because he saw this physical presence that could tear him apart. A.K. was a very gentle guy. If they're confronted by somebody who's really physically strong, and that often works.
I think that strength commanded a respect. And so there's different ways to command respect. And so each adult, each teacher, each parent has their own way. And so you learn what makes sense for you. Is it your size? Is it your voice? Is it your empathy? Is it the ability to listen? And there's so many right ways to do it, but the wrong way is to not enter into the discourse.
To ignore it, to think
to
it's going to
ignore it.
That's what Melody keeps coming back to. And that is, I really believe that is the key. And that's why you're good at what you do, is because you keep bringing it back to communication. I mean, that is, we've got to be able to talk with kids about this. Like with the bully, I mean, certainly we've got to ask the bully, what does bullying get you? And the kid says, well, it gets me respect. Well, I understand that. Are there some other ways that you can get respect without, you know, pushing people around? And for the bullied kid, you always ask, you know, what does the bully predict that you will do? Well, I'm going to cry. I'm going to back away. How can you violate that prediction? Because when you violate the prediction, the bully does not get what they want.
All right, let's go to Tom. He's calling us from Dallas, Texas. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call. I'm 63 years old, and I was one of the good boys, quote-unquote good boys, in school, but all the way from the fifth grade through about the 10th grade. Me and all my good buddies emotionally abused this girl who was poor. She dressed poorly, I guess, because that was all she could afford. Her mother or her grandmother would walk her to school every day because she was older. I mean, I don't know if she was, whether mother or grandmother, but every time we brushed against this girl, we would say, ooh, we got germs. We got to pass them on to our buddies to get rid of them. And this went on for years, and I think she finally dropped out of school at the 10th grade. I've been carrying this around for like 50 years. And would it do any good to get in touch with her? I think I can now. I think I found her number. And apologize, or would you just open up more wounds for her? I don't want to make her life any more miserable than we already have.
All right. Tom, thank you so much for your call. Carl, you're a psychologist. What do you think?
I think what I would do is I would write her, I think. I would write her as just a statement pretty much of what you just said. Said that this is something that has been bothering me for all these years. It's something I'm terribly sorry about. And that if there's anything that I can do by way of amends at this very late date, please let me know, and you are on no obligation to communicate back to me, and I will not be communicating with you again unless you want that.
Because that gives them the option of not having any contact.
Absolutely.
If they choose not.
Absolutely.
To.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, and this points out so painfully how critical it is on both sides of the issue.
Right.
And brings it back to the young people that we can help now. 50 years is an awful long time.
Isn't that extraordinary? Yeah.
Here's an email from Martha. She says, my daughter is the victim of exclusion at an all-girls school, and I suspect this is because she's attractive and at a party in the fall was popular with the boys, combined with the fact that she's very busy after school and does not have a lot of time for a social life. She has recently sobbed uncontrollably about the exclusion and does not want to stay at the school. So she says, number one, how can I know if there was a rumor about her that's contributing to this problem? And what should I do at this point? Patrick, what should she do?
This kind of rings a bell with me because I'm in this enormous, diverse high school. And we've had many girls who've come in from local private schools who love our school because they can find someone there to relate to. I remember one boy who came in from a private school and who was kind of excluded there because he said he didn't fit into the ethos, which was muscular Christianity. This was a brilliant kid. And he said the great thing about T.C. Williams, he said, no matter how weird you are, he said, you can find somebody like you. And I think one of the dangers in private schools that are small is that there's a certain dominant clique. And if you don't fit in, this is what the girls have told me that come into our school, you're just in big trouble. You're a pariah.
Well, do you think Martha should actually think about her daughter's feeling that she ought to actually change schools?
No. I mean, I think that would be a thing to be considered. But the fact that the daughter is very good looking and talented, she's going to have baggage maybe with other girls.
Carl, yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think that would be premature. I think the reality is that she thinks that, you know, nobody wants anything to do with her. The reality is there's a clique, a small group that she can't get into. What about the relationship with the other girls? Has she approached the other girls to get friendship? What about outside social circles? What can she do there? I mean, there's no point in knocking on the social door when it's always going to be closed, at least for the moment. So, you know, then you say, well, take your energy. Don't take it personally. It's them. It's not you. And see what other relationships you can create.
Now, Melody, you're the principal of a small private school. Do you see this phenomenon at work where there'll be a clique and everyone else feels excluded?
Yes and no. I think that the beauty of our school is that the goal, and we're not always successful in the goal, but the goal is one of acceptance. And I think that that goal keeps you honest in the conversation, all the arrows pointing in the same direction. And also being able to reflect when it's not successful is very important. I do see children get into scripts. And so they have a certain status or a certain position within their classroom. And part of the opportunity of having a small school is that you can help change those scripts. So a child that was always shy and couldn't raise their hand, you help bring them out. And it's a group effort. It's not just the adult effort. But you have to have a concerted right. goal and effort to change those scripts within any school.
Patrick.
I think this makes me think of sports because I've seen many kids who would be considered nerds or whatever, and they'll get involved in crew, they'll get involved in track or whatever, and they'll find a new peer group, and through their talent, that they're going to be accepted, and who's ever excluding them then just falls off the radar screen.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. Let's go to Julie, calling us from Jacksonville. Julie, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for this show. It is so relevant to our life right now. My daughter is actually just going through this right now. She stood up to a very close friend of hers because she had been making a derogatory remark to her, calling her a derogatory female name. And upon doing this, just evoked her wrath like you've never seen. And this girl went to all of their mutual friends and has, you know, told all of them these rumors about my daughter. And this past weekend, my daughter sat at home just so unhappy and crying. But one of the things that we decided to do was to stop her Facebook account and have her take a time out from texting because she was getting all of these texts from all of these friends, some people she didn't even know, accusing her of just being cruel and using bad language and those types of things. So I was wondering if that was the right course to take, if we did the right thing, just taking a time out and having everyone just take a deep breath.
And Julie, how old is your child?
She's 13.
13. Yeah. All right. Thanks so much for your call. Carl?
Yeah. I mean, that's unhappily a lot of par for the social course at that age, and what happens is that you get this kind of ganging up, which is people creating sides. The timeout is useful, but that's part of it. But part of it also is having her generate, you know, keep generating relationships. If timeout is isolation, that's not going to work. She's going to say, if I'm getting this negative stuff, I'm going to not listen to it. That's okay. But how else am I going to approach relationships and create relationships in my life? And parents need to say, you know, this is for the moment, it is not forever, and it's not everyone. It's not everyone.
Melody, what about the idea of taking away the Facebook account or trying to stop texting for a while? Does that make sense to you?
Oh, I think that this is such an individualistic thing that I'm afraid to provide what does and doesn't make sense. I think that in general, you can leave doors open for children and close them as need be. And I like what Carl says in that you remove the possibility of the technological pain. But again, every child and every adult is going to have to still deal with this on a very human level. And so the next step is, how will she approach the solutions, and how will she talk to other children regarding this?
Growing up is a hard thing to do. Right. I want to thank the three of you for joining us this hour in the Diane Rehm Show to talk about what we can do to make it a little bit easier. We've had Carl Picard, author of Why Good Kids Act Cruel, Melody Mead from the Washington International School, and Patrick Welsh from T.C. Williams High School in Alexandria, Virginia. Thank you all for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Yeah.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.